Blog Talk Radio.
Such men as Christ.
everybody, and welcome to the Renaissance Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy. We all hope that you're having a wonderful day today. I'm actually having a great one because, first of all, we broke into not only double-digit temperatures, but it is 21 Celsius out there right now, and I'm loving every minute of it. Winter, goodbye. But hello to Tim.
Well, you're all right there, Kel. Yes, and good evening to you, and good evening to all our listeners. And before I tell you what the weather is like over here, I suppose I should be courteous and say, how the devil are you tonight, Kel?
I am infidelly fine, and how about you?
Yes, I'm unbelievably good as well. And over here, it's absolutely freezing. I've had to be out. I've been out in the garden all afternoon, chiselling the blackbirds off the branches, and they fall off the branches down onto the concrete, and then they shatter into 1,000 pieces. So you know, it's not very environmentally friendly over here at all. The ground is now covered with shards of broken blackbirds. You know, but on the plus side, it does make it very much easier to scrape them up into a bowl, cover them with a little bit of mayonnaise, put them in the microwave, and you know, Bob's your uncle, bit of an afternoon snack. So not too bad at all, really. I suppose can't complain.
Well, you know what? I have had such a horrid winter here in Canada, as you know, as everybody knows, because I never shut up about it. It is just so nice now to finally get some temperatures going here in which I don't have to sleep underneath 14 million comforters and cringe when my heating bill arrives in the mail. So this is a very, very, very welcome indeed. But I am telling you, Tim, there is so much going on out there in the world again today. Boy, oh boy, what are we up to today?
Well, indeed. Islam is the gift that keeps on giving, as we like to say. But, of course, there's a very interesting question that's just popped into the chat room, which our listeners, I'm sure, would like to know the answer to, and that is, what's the latest on the mouse?
He's still running around in there. I have those mouse traps back. And yes, people, for your edification, when you post on my Facebook Mouse Saga Part 2, do not tell me to remove the plastic covering off the sticky. I have. You know, I am not a blonde. I just play one on the radio, for goodness sake.
I thought that was rather amusing. I mean, is there a knack to these mouse traps, or is it you've just got a mouse with an IQ of 150 in the house?
I don't know, but he's crafty. I don't know how he managed it, Tim, but he managed to. We have those sticky pads, and we put peanut butter on both of them. We have one on the top shelf of the Lazy Susan and one on the bottom shelf where he tends to sleep. Oh, I don't know what he does. But, well, I know what he does in there. He creates havoc is what he's doing. But so we put these sticky tape traps out, and we put peanut butter right in the middle, and the little bugger managed to get the peanut butter. Thus, everybody on my Facebook page is saying, well, why don't you remove the plastic? I did. I don't know. I think this mouse, what he's probably done is he's gotten it into a packet of spaghetti, and he's just taking this spaghetti noodle over there and scooping up the peanut butter and drawing back this a pole for him. And he's turning it around, and he's taking a little bite, and he's turning that pole around. He's a scooping.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, it's obvious when you think about it. I mean, peanut butter goes very well with spaghetti. So, you know, he's obviously a mouse with a bit of a gastronomic flair. You know, as a gastro mouse, you might call him. So, yeah, okay, sounds good. We're looking. I think this is going to turn into a real saga. I'm really looking forward to the next episode of the mouse in the house.
I'm taking photos. Everybody's going to know that I reigned victorious. But everybody's calling him Mighty Mo. Mighty Mouse, Mighty Mo Mouse. Because he's just as wily as that stupid prophet that went up into a mountain and came back down a crafty little creature. Mo the Mouse. But I will let everybody know when the situation is contained. Believe me, everybody will know via Facebook and on Blog Talk Radio. And I will probably share on all the shows I do. And you know what, Tim? I nearly welcomed everybody to Liberty GB.
Yeah, it can get kind of confusing. Yes.
Well, yeah. Agador says, Cal, as long as you don't get Fatima in your lazy season, that's all I need. Yeah, that's all I need is for this mouse to bring along his four wives. That would just be absolutely lovely because we know how they breed like rabbits. So we would have to be quite mindful of that. I would be a very, very unhappy infidel. Let's put it that way, Agador.
I suppose, on that note, I suppose you're lucky that you haven't got a rogue rabbit in your house. That would be even worse. And you could come on the show and said, this rabbit is breeding like a rabbit. And then you'd be in real trouble.
Tim, don't quit your day job, okay?
Okay. Confucius, he say, when in holes, stop digging. So I guess I'd better turn the microphone back over to you and ask you what we have on the menu tonight, as it were, to talk about this evening.
Well, I came across this article. I come across so many articles, and I have a few of them, but in particular, as everybody knows, Tim and myself, we're both huge fans of Dr. Bill Warner, and he has a YouTube page, and he puts out maybe 4, maybe 5 minute long YouTube videos. And his latest one that he discussed was the Islamists playing the victim card, and the tagline accompanying that YouTube video is, when Islam oppresses others, there is always a complaint by Muslims that they are the ones who are the real victims. And this is because of the Quran and the Sunnah of Muhammad. And I had been doing a little bit of reading, and I also came across some other articles. He had some pretty wacky ideas about animals, too, Tim. But we have this clip by Dr. Bill Warner, which we will play for you a little later on. But it's true, Tim. Every time something happens, oh, the Muslims feel it, too. You know, they feel our pain. I was at Bare Naked Islam, as a matter of fact, and I'm just going to go off on a bit of a tangent. But the first anniversary of the Boston bombing is coming up next month.
Yeah.
And, of course, all the Muslims are filing out. And, we felt the pain. We were just as victimized as everybody else. And there's one person in particular. She converted to Islam shortly after the Boston bombings, and she's going to run in the marathon wearing her jihad. And her hijab, rather.
Hijab,
and,
yeah.
I make up words as I go along too, folks. But yeah, she's determined that she's going to run in this marathon wearing her hijab, Leanna Scorzoni. And so she is trying to, you know, bridge the gap between the Islamophobes, people like you and me, and true Muslims who, you know, are equally victimized by events such as this, the Boston bombings, and maybe 9/11, 7/7. But I come across these stories all the time, and I just want to punch through my computer and just strangle them, because it's like, you know what, you're not a victim. You're an abettor to the greater cause of jihad within Islam. So they try to sell us a bill of goods, Tim, all the time, saying, look, we're just like you, and we don't like this either. Well, okay, you know what? I'm sure there are a lot of Muslims out there that don't. But all the same, they're not doing a damn thing about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is this is a typical response to any kind of Muslim atrocity, the first thing that happens is you'll get a Muslim spokesman out there who will say, not only was this nothing to do with true Islam, or the people who committed the atrocity were not true Muslims, but we also fear a Muslim backlash. So we're going to do everything we can to make it known just how much of a victim we all feel. And it then projects the guilt onto the rest of us, because obviously we don't think that all Muslims are necessarily bad. I think, you know, with the best will in the world, we'd have to say that there are some Muslims out there who wish us harm. But there are many Muslims, and I'm not going to put a percentage on it, who don't particularly wish us harm, and who would probably wish that the whole concept of Islamic terrorism would just disappear. But they're not about to help it along in any way, because at the end of the day, if they subscribe to the ideology that would enslave us all through fear, violence, intimidation and terror, if they subscribe to that ideology, they cannot really say a great deal against it without being accused of not really being true Muslims. So yeah, you might say, well, it's a problem. So I there are a lot of Muslims out there who I'm sure would feel a lot better if we just took all the guilt on ourselves, and they'll do anything that they can to help us along. Now, that might be a slightly cynical viewpoint, but nevertheless, if you look at the various arguments surrounding this, and you say, what is more likely? Is it likely that they are really and truly trying to do something positive to bridge the gap between Muslim and non-Muslim? Is that more likely, or is it more likely that they're just using taqiyya and dissimulation in various forms in order to make us think that the fault is entirely on our side? And by what I have seen, I would, well, if I were to take a straw poll amongst our listeners this evening, I think we know where the answer would fall. But yes, it is something we regularly see.
And they don't take responsibility for the writings within their Quran. And I like what Agador said, that if they're into the Quran, they're part of the problem. If you are a Muslim, you're a devout Muslim, then you are following the dictates of the Quran, and the Quran has a lot of very, very nasty things within it. Everybody knows that. We don't have to elaborate on that. We have smart listeners, as usual, there, Tim. But if they are practicing Muslims, they are advocating the teachings in the Quran, and they are following Sharia law. And so I know there's a lot of people out there who are trying to reform Islam while still practicing Islam. People like Dr. Zudi Jasser comes to mind, of course. But I don't think that there is going to be any reformation within Islam, not in our lifetime anyway. Well, you know, they've been stuck on stupid since the 7th century. Nothing has evolved since its inception in the 7th century. And therefore, I see no reason to trust anything a Muslim says to me.
Well, quite. If we're talking about reform in Islam, of course there have been attempts over the years to reform Islam, and the one that springs to mind most frequently is the St. Petersburg Declaration of 2007, which we did talk about only a few weeks ago on the show, and that was I say it was a brave attempt. It was an attempt by a mixture of Muslims and ex-Muslims to provide a framework whereby Islam might be reformed. And that, I suppose if you were to condense it down to a nutshell, basically involved taking all the nasty bits out of the Quran and having it, the idea would be to have it generally accepted that those nasty bits were no longer applicable in any way, shape or form, and that Muslims should concentrate on the non-violent bits that preach peace and love to everybody. So once you've found that page, maybe you'll let me know. But the point is that if you take all the violent bits out of the Quran and try and hold up what's left as an example of you know, the Islamic text. It's not Islam at all. It's something completely different. And the reason that that never caught on from the St. Petersburg Declaration in 2007 is, of course, that pretty much all the Muslims in whatever sect, wherever in the world they might be, recognized it as a futile exercise, because Islam is Islam and that's it, as Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey memorably said not too long ago. Us non-Muslims can tie ourselves in knots trying to decide what is good Islam, what is moderate Islam, what is radical Islam. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of Muslims out there who subscribe to the same view of that Prime Minister Erdogan does, which is to say Islam mm-hmm. is Islam and that's it. And talk of good, moderate or radical Islam is really doing nothing positive in order to solve the problem. What it does do is make us non-Muslims feel good and fuzzy on the inside to think that we're actually doing something constructive towards solving the problem. But it's a fool's errand. There is no way you can reform Islam, because Islam was designed right from the start not to be reformable. And Muslims recognize this, that if you dispute or argue one word or if you try to alter anything to do with Islam, you are not a Muslim. You cannot be a Muslim if you question the nature of Islam or the life of the Prophet Muhammad. And Quran chapter 5 verse 101-102 tells you this very clearly. You must not question. Yeah. And the penalties for questioning are to have your status as a Muslim effectively revoked. Not in a formal way, but other Muslims will be free to kill you if you happen to live in a Muslim community or in a Muslim country. They will be perfectly at liberty under the Sharia to kill you for questioning Islam in any way, shape or form, which is why, of course, you don't see a lot of Muslim reformers. And barely a week goes by, if you're a regular viewer of the religionofpeace.com website, barely a week goes by where you don't read about some Muslim imam or cleric who happens to make an innocuous remark along the lines of, wouldn't it be nice if we stopped killing people, or something like that. And sure enough, a day or so later, he's gunned down, and that's another potential reformer who's been killed as an example to everybody else. So Islam rules by fear, as it always has. Over 1400 years, it's ruled by fear, violence, intimidation and terror. And that, combined with the death sentence for apostasy and those two things make up two very good reasons why people do not reform Islam or indeed try to leave it. Because if you try to leave it, you can suffer all sorts of problems in your personal life or your family life or the relationships with your peers. And that's why we just don't see so much of it, because the penalties for questioning or for apostatizing are so dire. Despite what Muslims may tell you. Muslims will tell you, of course, that the penalty for apostasy no longer applies today. It might have been something that applied in the past under certain circumstances. They say, of course, Islam allows for questioning. It encourages critical thinking, all of which, of course, falls under the category of taqiyya, because it is an absolute fiction. It's a lie, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, I'm sure you don't need me to tell you, but it's worthwhile mentioning these things every now and again on shows like this, in case we get new listeners who aren't familiar perhaps with some of the niceties when it comes to the details of Islamic doctrine.
And reading this article, I put the link from Bare Naked Islam in the chat room for everybody, but the original article is from The New Yorker. And that this person, this Boston Marathon wannabe, Leanna Scorzoni, who converted to Islam, she said that the Muslim community was also hurt by the bombings. But I don't know what they're trying to accomplish when they engage in these sort of activities because we're Islamophobic up, and we don't care that the Islamic community was also hurt by the bombings. We really don't. And for this to be a featured story in The New Yorker, and they've got a photo of her here, and she's got some guy in a dress standing beside her. I think he's an imam. And probably on the other side is one of the organizers of the Boston Marathon, and they have a poster-sized photo of her standing behind it, and that is her marathon number. And this is really irking me in that this is, I won't say it's techie, it probably is, but I don't want to go right there with it. Where I want to go with this is that quit shoving your goodwill down our throats, because we know what Islam is, we know what Islam is capable of, and if you were hurt by the bombings, where were you with your rallies, and where were you condemning the actions of the Boston bombers last May? Where were you? No, you slink back, you hide, you ignore, and then you come out and say, hey, look, we are good people, and look at good old Leanne there. Look at her, you know. She's going to show solidarity for the Boston Marathon this year, and she's going to show us that Muslims really are just like us, when we know, in fact, that they are not, Tim.
Yeah, well, when I used the word taqiyya, what I should maybe have used was the word maruna, because Islamic deception has several forms. Taqiyya is lying in order to promote Islam or to prevent its denigration in the eyes of non-Muslims. And while she certainly is engaging in that, maruna really... really means a form of deception, which is means that they're trying to blend in so that they don't stand out in such a way as to receive the opprobrium that other Muslims might do. I suppose you could also say it's dissimulation or kitman in another form, because it's designed to deflect attention away from what the true issue is. The true issue is that on the anniversary, well, on 1 year ago, when the Boston bombs went off, they were planted by Muslims who were doing that particular act in the name of Islam. And the inescapable conclusion that you have to come to is that there are plenty of Muslims who would be only too happy to do a very similar thing if they thought that it would earn them brownie points from Allah by killing infidels. They'd be only too happy to do it. So for one Muslim to come along and say, well, you know, Islam isn't like that at all, is not doing us any favours. They might be attempting to show what a nice person they are individually. And for all I know, her intentions might be sincere. She might not actually know too much about the Islamic doctrine that you and I have the misfortune, I might say, to know about. We know this. There are some days I wake up and I sometimes think, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to make the effort to learn so much about Islam, because if Islam were in fact a benign and tolerant religion of peace, as Muslims claim it is, we would all be better off. But the fact is, it is not a benign and tolerant religion of peace. It is a violent totalitarian ideology, completely ruthless in nature, and no amount of posturing by Muslims, whether they be converts or otherwise, is going to change that. And no matter how much Muslims might say, look, we're like non-Muslims in so many ways, you know, we subscribe to doing nice sporty things like you people do, and that's just one example, but there are all sorts of ways where Muslims are appearing to try and bridge a gap. But what they're doing is they're obfuscating. They are hiding or causing the real intentions of Islam to be obscured. And that makes it harder for non-Muslims who don't know too much about Islam to discern where the real problem is. I mean, you and I, Kel, and all our listeners, I'm quite sure, understand where the real problems are with Islam and what would have to be done by Muslims if they were sincere in trying to solve this problem. But they have no interest. There is no benefit to Muslims themselves in solving this problem, because if they persist in doing what they have been doing over the last 1400 years, and if we persist in our suicidal political correctness and multiculturalism to accept ever increasing numbers of Muslims in our civilization, we will lose everything that our forefathers and our ancestors have handed down to us through sacrifices of literally of blood and treasure over the previous generations. We'll lose it. So it's up to us, because Muslims, no matter how, with the best will in the world, somebody like that who may not know much about Islam, and that they're trying to promote a good picture of Islam, they're just making it that much more difficult for the rest of us to solve the problem by trying to we need to identify exactly what the problem is and how to solve it. And Muslims like that are not helping, quite the reverse.
I like what you said about Maruna and the point you brought up with this particular individual. Yes, perhaps she is, in all sincerity, trying to bridge the gap. But there is something else that we have to be aware of, and this is that she is being steered by something. She is fulfilling that role, the role of Maruna within Western societies. She is the poster child for that. Whether she knows it or not, she is. And this blending in business, and that is perfect. That's so apt. She may be, as an individual, in all sincerity, in that she wants to bring about a deeper understanding and the relationship of Islam and its role in the West, and she wants to, in all sincerity, yes, perhaps, she does. But she's a puppet, and she is a useful idiot for the Islamists. People like this, I find them to be nothing more than useful idiots, which she is, my opinion. Yeah. And if she is denigrated in any way whatsoever for her wanting to participate in the Boston Marathon, well, you know, we'll get that care-inspired Islamophobe and, it's Muslim Brotherhood inspired, but she'll be the poster child for victimology. So, we can't win for losing.
That is the problem if we swallow that narrative. Now, I don't know the circumstances under which she converted to Islam. It does give a few clues in the article. She'd gone along to a bookstore and talked to the owner for a while, and then she started attending some of the prayer services. And you can just imagine the welcome that she would have received from various people who saw, potentially another convert. As we know, Muslims are very hot on proselytizing, and if they see that they can make a convert out of somebody, they will put the effort in to do it. And that includes being as nice as you possibly can be to them, and presenting the good side of Islam to them in a way to make them feel that they're very welcome. And, I mean, who knows what sort of background people like that have, that feel drawn to Islam. They may find there's something missing in their lives, and that they need something in the way of an extended family. This is hypothetical, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm extrapolating perhaps where I shouldn't, but I'm just giving a potential example of how vulnerable people are easily converted, and we know that because this is what we see in prisons. Prisons are filled with largely vulnerable people who are susceptible to this kind of thing, and that's why you get conversion rates in prisons are as high as they are. But even if people aren't in prison, there's still a lot of vulnerable people out there for one reason or another. And if they find that they're presented or surrounded by a lot of very friendly people who seem to form part of an extended group that has, I don't know, all sorts of potential benefits on the surface. It's easy to see how people might get drawn in, but if you don't acquaint yourself with exactly what Islam is, in comparison to what Muslims would like you to think it is, then you're going to be effectively deluded into believing something that isn't true. And this is what we find so often with converts. I mean, some converts can be some of the most zealous Muslims that you can find. And it's not unusual to find converts to Islam fighting in foreign countries. I mean, we know this from recent stories from the UK, where UK-born Muslims have travelled to Syria and have been fighting in the conflict over there because of Islam. They think it's the right thing to do to fight the infidel in the name of Islam, to fight for Allah. And if they get killed, well, what does it matter? You know, they get promised 72 virgins in paradise and all this. We know how effective Islam can be when it comes to persuading converts to do the most heinous things in the name of Allah. So when you've got a situation like that, you have to ask, well, the question that should be asked is, does this young lady know exactly what she's getting into? And I imagine she probably doesn't. But if you were to try and say that to her directly, she'd probably be very offended, because she doesn't want to think that, or I imagine she wouldn't want to think that her newfound family, that there'd be anything wrong with them at all. And that's the danger, is that talking to people like that, you're unlikely to be able to convince them that they're not doing the right thing. But that's human nature for you, I suppose. And I think it's given that we have this kind of situation with converts who then take up the cause of Islam in a very zealous way, the only thing you can do is to present the other side of the story and say, well, there is another side, and it's not nearly as pleasant as the side that has been told to the person who's doing the conversion. It's not a popular story to tell. And a lot of people, when you're trying to tell it, will say you're nothing but a racist and a bigot and Islamophobe and all that. But nevertheless, it is the truth. And we have to find a way of telling it to people and explaining the cause to people in such a way that they are persuaded of the rightness of our cause. On that subject, I must say, I'll briefly bring this up before I hand the microphone back to you, Kel, that Agador made a very, very interesting suggestion yesterday when we were on the show concerning the presentation of our struggle, not as being something or against Islam or against jihad, although we are against those things. The presentation that Agador suggested was to frame the whole struggle in the form of a civil rights issue, because it is. Mm-hmm. We're on the side of humanity against the most pernicious totalitarian ideology that the world has ever seen. And that pernicious ideology is gaining ground because we have not yet mounted an effective argument that is persuading sufficient numbers of people quickly enough. But to frame the struggle in terms of civil rights is not a bad idea at all. There is a precedent. We discussed it yesterday on the show. If I can only find the link, I'll put it into the chat room. And that was from a chap called Eric Allen Bell, who was at one time a left-leaning liberal until he saw the light and became a committed counter-jihadist. And he expressed a very similar view on video on YouTube, which I dropped into the chat room of the show we were on yesterday. And it's quite an interesting perspective. And if I can find it, I'd like to drop it into the chat room, unless Kel beats me to it. And then we can let our listeners have the benefit of that. But, framing the issue as a civil rights movement rather than being always against Islam or against jihad or against the Sharia. People don't like to hear the word against, because people don't like to be against things generally, by and large.
Exactly.
They like to be for things. And if they can be for things that are seen to be good by their peers, that makes them happier. It goes against the grain somewhat for a lot of people to be against things rather than for them. So that's just something that our listeners might like to think about. But I'll hand the microphone back to you, Kel. And if you haven't already found this particular link, I'm going to see if I can drop it into the chat room.
Okay. But I also like, and just to remind people, Agador was speaking on the English Defense League radio show yesterday when he brought that up. And Agador, he also brought up something else in that he said that there is very much a problem that when we do try to do our civic duty and we treat our opposition to the encroachment of Islam within our Western societies, we're called all sorts of names, we're not what the Islamists would like to label us. We're not Islamophobe. We do not engage in any hate mongering of any sort. We're not like that. We are simply trying to explain why Islam is not compatible with the West. And so I liked the way Agador framed that on Jeff Mitchell's show yesterday as well. But Tim, what we should do is that I've got this nifty clip here, and this is from Dr. Bill Warner, and this is him discussing Islamic victims. We'll play that, and we'll see everybody back here in 5 minutes.
And I've got the link in the chat room as well, so away you go.
Perfect. All right. Slow startup.
Well, I recently had the venue for a speech canceled because the Muslims felt like that they were being victimized. And if you'll notice in dealing with Islam, the Muslim is always the victim, sometimes under the most bizarre circumstances. For instance, on 9/11, when the World Trade Towers were destroyed, Muslims said that they were the true victims, not the poor 3,000 Kafirs. This victim attitude that Muslims have comes straight from the Quran and straight from the Sunnah of Muhammad. For instance, after Muhammad left Mecca and went to Medina, he thought a lot about what had happened to him and finally decided that he needed some justice, and that this justice would be found by raiding the Meccan caravans. It took Muhammad's jihadists 8 times before they were actually able to kill some Meccans and to kidnap and steal the property. And guess what? The Quran says that the real victims were the Muslims who did this. Because you see, earlier the Meccans had thrown Muhammad out of Mecca, and throwing him out of Mecca is worse than murder. So Muslims are always the victims. They're never wrong. But it got me thinking, it would be interesting to show how Muslims create victims. For instance, I've already told you one. The pagans of Mecca, the pagans of Arabia, were Muhammad's first victims. Then the next victim he had were the Jews of Medina. Because when he moved to Medina, it was half Jewish. But 2 years later, the 3 Jewish tribes were gone, enslaved, and exiled. So his next victims were the Jews. And soon after he got to Medina, we have another victim, which are children, because Muhammad married Aisha when she was 6 and consummated the marriage when she was 9. This makes her, as a child, a victim. But there were more victims to be found in Medina, that is, slaves. You see, Islam has been the biggest slaver in the world, and the slave taking started in Medina, and the first slaves were Jews, because although Muhammad killed 800 Jewish men by beheading them, the women were sold as slaves. Oh, and the children, the Jewish children, they were adopted into Muslim families to be raised as Muslims. And it was in Medina also that another set of victims were established in Islam, that of women. Muhammad established through a whole series of traditions that beating your wife was, well, not a good thing, at least an acceptable thing. One of his more famous hadith is, never ask a man why he beats his wife. Well, now women are the victims of Islam. And Allah weighed in on this issue as well, because in Surah 4, women, it says that men can beat their wives and gives a succession of steps on how to do this in the proper way. Then when Islam left Arabia behind its jihadists, it found new victims. For instance, as it moved east, it found Hindus as victims, and then it found Sikhs as victims, and it found Buddhists as victims. So you get the idea here that although Muslims are always the poor, aggrieved victims, they are the oppressors, big time. But it goes beyond human beings. You see, Muhammad, for reasons which are not clear to us, didn't like dogs, and so dogs became a victim of Islam. Oddly enough, there was a peculiar kind of snake that Muhammad didn't like, and so they became victims as well as the Muslims tried to clean all this particular kind of snake out. But now we get to another victim, critical thought. Because you see, the Sharia forbids critical thought. It forbids any thought which contradicts any aspect of Islam. Islam is perfect, it's true, and so therefore anything which contradicts it is false, and it's simply not allowed. One of the thoughts you might have if you're a Muslim is, you know, I might like to leave Islam, but no. You cannot leave Islam, or if you do, you can be killed. So Islam is a little bit like that Hotel California song. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave. So critical thought's a victim, and here's what we see today, is that Islamic suppression of critical thought is on the rise. As more and more Muslims go to the federal government and the state government and say, oh, we're being victimized by these oppressors who want to quote from the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sirah, so you must shut them down. Critical thought on Islam is not allowed. All this bit of victims has made me decide that the best way to approach Islam is through its victims. And it is for this purpose that I've created a brochure movement which I call Voices for the Voiceless. So if you would like to see how the victims of Islam can be turned to good, go to politicalislam.com and click on the little button that says Voices for Voiceless. Thank you.
And welcome back, everybody. Dr. Bill Warner once again summed it up beautifully there, Tim.
Yes, he did. I was really quite impressed by the way in which he laid it all out and led to the logical conclusion that, yes, indeed, we should be highlighting Muslims over 1,400 years have been the oppressors of all these groups. I was just trying to think of what kind of snake it was that Muslims were getting so exercised about. And I do remember that in a hadith, and I can't for the life of me find the hadith at the minute, but I'm sure I will, that in fact salamanders were a particular problem. And I don't know why, but it was quite detailed in this hadith that if you killed a salamander, it was as if you had performed 10 other good deeds in other areas, and you'd get so many extra points towards going to paradise. And the more salamanders you killed, you know, the proportionately the amount of points rose, and until you were able to if you were allowed entry to paradise, you would get all sorts of extra goodies on top of the 72 virgins. And although I can't think what more you would want if you got 72 virgins, you'd probably end up with 72 mothers-in-law. So I don't know quite what you would do in paradise in order to get the benefits from that. But I digress. The way that Bill Warner summarized all these victims, I thought was really well laid out. We have talked to Bill Warner in the past, Kel, about his project, mm-hmm. Voices for the Voiceless, and I know we're hoping to get him back onto our show in the very near future to elaborate on how that project is developing. But the concept behind that particular project is not too dissimilar from what we were talking about before the break. Instead of where I was saying that instead of concentrating on all the bad things that we are against, if we frame our struggle in terms of a civil rights struggle to support the values of humanity against a totalitarian ideology that would enslave us all, that could reach people who might otherwise be deaf to what we have to say. And in the same way, Voices for the Voiceless, the project that Bill Warner is involved with, concentrates on the victims of Islam and is designed to make people realize that what they should be doing, rather than listening to what Muslims have got to say about how much they are victims, what they should be doing is concentrating on the real victims of Islam. We were talking specifically about Christian persecution around the world the last time we spoke to Bill Warner, but nevertheless, mm-hmm. the concept is good for all the categories of victims that Bill was talking about, whether they're whether they've been Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, women, children, slaves, dogs, snakes. They are all victims, and if we say, wouldn't it be a much, much better use of our time to concentrate on helping these victims and speaking up for these victims, in the, it would make people realize that, well, if there's victims, maybe they'll start to think, well, who's doing the victimizing? Who is doing the oppression? And then at that point, we don't actually have to say to these people, it's Muslims that are doing all this. If we just say that victims are being created and we need to do whatever we can to help them in whatever way possible, people will come to that conclusion themselves, because people aren't that stupid. People will realize that where there are victims, there is somebody out there doing the victimizing, doing the oppression, and, oh, look, it's Muslims. So it's a very, very good way to approach it, and I applaud Bill Warner for that project. I'm very, very keen to have him back on our show so we can talk to him again and see how that project's coming along. But yeah, most impressive, Kel, most impressive.
He's very, very good, and he's also a very nice man. You know, you talk with him on the phone, he's cooking, and he's asking you if you want to eat.
Yes, indeed.
But, I did come across this article earlier today. That's why I put in the show highlights that Muhammad had some pretty weird ideas about animals. And those snakes that you're referring to is kill snakes and kill do at Tufia 10. That's interesting. I.e. a snake with two white lines on its back and albatross, i.e. a snake with short or mutilated tails. For they sought to destroy the sight of one's eyes and bring about abortion. Like, Muhammad had some really weird ideas about animals. He did not like animals at all. He did not like dogs, didn't like snakes, didn't like, let's just say he would not be getting a humanitarian award by the Humane Society anytime soon, because he was just absolutely crazy. But, yeah, talking about the true victims of Islam, they always come out with the race card, the victim card, and that, well, you know, this happened, but we were victims too. But Agador put something in the chat room, and I want to read this. This is a letter written by Dr. Saeed, or Pastor Saeed Abedini, who is being held in an Iranian prison, and he wrote this week to wish us well for our Easter. And this is from... There are two links that AGG put in here, and I clicked on the highlighted, and it took me to ACLJ. And this is American Pastor Saeed. He writes the Easter message as a prisoner in the darkness of Iran. Happy Resurrection Day. On the eve of Good Friday and Easter, I was praying for my hospital room for my fellow Christians in the world. What the Holy Spirit revealed to me in prayer was that there are many dead faiths in the midst of Christians today, that Christians all over the world are not able to fully reach their spiritual potential that has been given to them as a gift by God, so that in reaching that potential, the curtain can be removed and the glory of God be revealed. Sometimes we want to experience the glory and resurrection with Jesus without experiencing death with him. We do not realize that unless we pass through the path of death with Christ, we are not able to experience resurrection with Christ. We want to have a good and successful marriage, career, education, and family life, which is also God's desire and plan for our life. But we forget that in order to experience the resurrection and glory of Christ, we first have to experience death with Christ and to die to ourselves and selfish desires. Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." Matthew chapter 16, verse 24. This means that we should not do things that we like to do, that God does not want us to do, and to do things that we do not like to do, but God wants us to do, so that he may be glorified. So in addition to spending our days and night in doing the works of faith as described above, we should also transform our death faiths into living and active faiths through the resurrection of Christ, which is an active and constructive love that is effective. In conclusion, let us resurrect our dead faith to living faiths by first dying to be our self-resurrected self in experiencing the cross of Jesus. Then we are able to experience the glorious resurrection with Christ. A glorious life with Christ starts only after a painful death to self with Christ. We will start with Christ. This is from Pastor Saeed Abedini, prisoner in the darkness in Iran, but free in the kingdom and light. And to remind people, Pastor Abedini went over to Iran to build orphanages and was arrested for proselytizing. He's an American citizen being held in an Iranian prison. He's very ill, and we are praying for his safe return to his wife, Nagma, and their two young children. So I want to thank Agador very much for that, because Pastor Saeed Abedini is always close in my heart. My heart bleeds for all of these victims being persecuted in these Islamic countries because they follow a faith which is incompatible with the darkness of Islam. And Tim, there you go.
Yes, indeed. And I echo Kel's words entirely on that. Thanks a great deal for that, Agador, because it's important to keep things like this at the forefront of our minds, because this man, as Kel said, went over to Iran to do some good works for the people there and has suffered horribly in consequence. You don't need me to tell you how appalling it was recently when America was negotiating with Iran about the nuclear issue. President Obama had every opportunity to bring up the subject of the pastor in the negotiations and conspicuously failed to do so. And I thought that was an appalling omission, because it would have cost him nothing. It would have it would have at least given the Christians amongst us at least an idea that he wasn't entirely devoted to Muslims at the expense of everybody else, but he manifestly failed to bring the subject of Pastor Abedini up during those negotiations. And all right, I suppose this isn't really the forum for letting off steam about President Obama, but all the same, I just thought I'd mention that, because I think it was pretty appalling. I that's a very strong message that the pastor put in his letter there, and all the more inspiring because he wrote it under conditions of extreme brutality and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand what he's saying, that it's only when you can experience the death of the self that you can go beyond that. And I have to declare, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not specifically a religious person in the sense that I don't go to church every Sunday, but that's not to say that I'm completely devoid of spiritual experiences. And one such experience is something that I don't want to make too much of it, because it's not specifically related to Christianity, but there is a concept within Aikido. People who follow the things that I've said and written will know I'm a devotee of Aikido, and one of the concepts in Aikido is that you can never experience the true enlightenment until you have defeated yourself. Now that's a concept that's somewhat alien in the way that I've expressed it, but it's quite a common concept in Japanese martial arts. And in Japanese, it's called Masakatsu Akatsu. And just to bring home the fact that this is an important concept to me, I actually have it tattooed on my arm, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen. And it's something which I would commend to anybody. If you really want to experience true enlightenment, you have to give up an awful lot of pretty much everything, really, when it comes to your previous material life, and to consider yourself. You have to give yourself completely to something which might seem a very, very hard thing to do, to give up everything that you've pursued in your previous life in order to achieve that level of enlightenment. It's a hard thing to explain, and I'm not really sure that I should be trying to draw analogies between Japanese martial arts and the Christian message. But nevertheless, I think there's a parallel there, and I just wanted to let people know that when I say these words, I'm not just mouthing platitudes and just agreeing with Kel because she's there on the other end of the line. I think it's a really important issue. And the fact that somebody in Pastor Abedini's position is able to enunciate this and broadcast it to the world when he's experiencing the suffering that he is, I think it's an inspiration to us all.
Absolutely agreed. See, these are the true victims. Islam has absolutely no, they have no dominion over victimhood, none whatsoever, because they are the victimizers. And Pastor Sayyid Abedini is an example of that. But Tim, let's take a little bit of a break. I've got a song here that I want to play. And I also want to remind people that we have a contest going on, okay?
Oh, yes, yes, of course. Well, I forgot to mention that right at the start of the show. All right, I'm so excited, I'm just going to have to pass the mic back to you so you can tell the listeners all about it.
Okay. Well, as you know, we have these beautiful limited edition coffee mugs with our little friend Fayez Magal of Tell Mama, the mendacious, grievance-mongering taqiyya artist. Limited edition coffee mug can be yours if you can answer one of our trivia questions that we put out every week. Now, you do not have to phone in, but if you would like to call in, the number is 347-237-4318. If you're in our chat room, though, you can just send me a private message, answer the question, and I will get your mailing details, and the mug can be yours. And believe me, you will really love this mug. Believe me, you'll make Fayez Magal totally hot when you pour your hot steaming coffee or tea into it.
Well, that's a new slant on it, Kel. I usually tell the listeners that, you know, in years to come, these mugs are going to be extremely sought after. I have to say they're a limited edition mug. When people come to look at valuing wealth in years to come, and somebody asks them, well, have you got a great master on your wall like a Renoir or a Van Gogh or a Manet, people will say, no, but I do have a mendacious, grievance-mongering taqiyya artist coffee mug from 2014, the year of the Birmingham taqiyya trial. And I tell you what, that's going to be an heirloom that's going to be worth millions in the future, I tell you now. So get your pens at the ready, ladies and gentlemen, to write down the answer and let Kel know what the answer is, because one of these mugs can be yours.
Absolutely. And today's trivia question is, we are taking a song break. Listen to this song and tell me, and Tim, what movie did this come from?
Even you.
Welcome back, everybody. And just to remind you that you are listening to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Tim Burton and Cal Fritzy. And, Tim, hang on. Just one sec. I am I am so excited. We, guess what?
You've got a caller. You've got a caller.
We do. Well, we have a winner. We do.
Oh, excellent.
And I would like to congratulate H12 Iggy Mom in the chat room. She has guessed the question. Of course, the answer to the trivia question was that thing you do. So, Iggy, we want to congratulate you very much. I'm going to get your mailing details, and that mug is in the mail on the way to you. Once again, Iggy Mom is the winner this week. Woohoo, Tim! Yay!
Woohoo!
Da 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 da. And Iggy just sent me her mailing details, so thank you, Iggy, very much. And enjoy that mug. You will cherish it for years to come. You will be passing it down to your children, and they'll be passing it down to theirs. So there you go, Tim. Da 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 da.
Yep, that's excellent news. Congratulations, Iggy Mum. Well done. Good
and
stuff.
There you go. Yeah. Oh, and just to remind people that we're having this contest because Tim has the I have the link to Tim's website in the show notes, and if you go there, if you want, and you're not obligated to, please. I only show for Tim because I like my co-host, and I'm kind of relieved that he did not go to jail. But this court case cost him a lot of money, so if you want to donate to his defense fund, by all means, feel free to do so. Feel free to do so, everybody. And on that note, Tim, there you go.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed, Kel. And as I always say, if you've got a few pennies to spare, it would be extremely welcome. Legal costs, unfortunately, in a case like this, don't run cheap, even if you win the case. And it certainly would be appreciated. And this is the point where I normally say, what am I talking about? A few pennies? What am I talking about? What I mean is, sell your house, sell your car, sell your wife's jewelry, sell your dog, sell your wife, and put the money into the Cat Strangler 101 Legal Defense Fund as soon as you possibly can. You know it makes sense. So thank you very much for that shout-out, Kel.
Absolutely.
And, Agador has also mentioned that we were talking the other day about putting a link together for Sonny, because we wanted to do something to help him after all the troubles that he'd experienced at the hands of his local culture enrichers. And I think you had a link to put into the chat room, Kel. And in fact, there it is. I can see it now. So you're way ahead of me there. So thank you very much for that, Kel.
Oh, you betcha, Vito. Oh, I'm saying hello to Vito, and I'm talking to you at the same time, Bob. What's your name? What's my name? Mom, where am I?
And there was me. There was me congratulating you on how well you can multitask. I don't know. Oh dear.
Am I fired?
Oh, you're so fired. Yes. Well done. Well done, Kel. Well done.
And there you go. I'm not editing that out.
Good. Yes, indeed. We've got this fund for Sonny, whereby we're going to help him with the setting up of some kind of deterrent for the culture enrichers in his area. Personally, I'd go around there with a big can of, what's that, DEET or mosquito killer. Is it DEET? To get rid of the mozzies.
I think it's called DEET, yeah.
Yeah, I think so, to get rid of the mozzies. But I don't think we've got a can big enough to get rid of that lot. So what we're doing is we're looking to set up some kind of surveillance system for for his family home to deter these people from doing what they're doing. So anything that you can spare would be very welcome. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll hand the mic back to you, Kel.
And just to remind you that we were discussing the self-imposed victimhood of Islam, and it is self-imposed because they try to make themselves the victims, and they're not victims. They're perpetrators of atrocities. But one thing I forgot to do, Tim, as well, is to thank all our friends for joining us in the chat room, and our winner, A12, Iggy Mom. Agador, uh-huh. Jeff of English Defense League, Freedom Show, which is our Anna, all the way from Spain. We have a guest joining us. That might be Terry. I'm not too sure. We have No Way 90 and Vito Esposito, who is our boss over there at the Radio Jihad Network. And we want to thank everybody that listens in the archive, and we want to thank you, though. The people in the chat room, you're taking time out of your otherwise busy day to spend with us, so we thank you all very much for being here. Now, yes, we're talking about the issue of Islam and how they are whiners and that they are playing the Islamic victim card. They are quite adept at doing that. And there was there was another story I came across when I was doing, I was doing a few things here. And one story I came across, now this is over a year old, but I think it's timeless in that we can discuss it. What is going on in a lot of communities in North America and in England, I'm sure, it's certainly happening in Canada, is that Muslims are buying private residences and they're converting them into mosques. And what they're doing, of course, is that when that sort of thing starts to happen, the real estate values go down. There was a case here about a year ago in which this group of Muslims, they got together, they pulled their money, and they bought a house in San Bernardino County in California. But they got all upset because the residents of this rural area, they kept trying to take them to court because they were saying, we don't want this house purchased by this particular Islamic group. And the reason why they were taking them to court was because the Muslims, first of all, the Muslims believe it just has nothing to do with, it just has everything actually to do with Islamophobia. But these Muslims, they wanted to convert this private residence into a mosque. And so the lawyer for the residents, he said, no, that's not the case at all. The residents just want the Muslims to obey the same laws that they have to obey. Now, the problem began when the Muslims bought yet another home in a quiet residential area and decided to turn it into a place of worship, a mosque. Now, anyone who has ever been involved in buying land for a church and building a church or on the property or converting existing buildings into a church know the process can be very complex when it comes to jumping through all the hoops put in place by the city and county. Now, when the group is allowed to use the purchased residential home, the stipulation is that there be no more than 30 people in there at one time because it is a home. And the number and size of bathrooms does not support a larger number. Now, one Muslim involved in the process has accused current residents of being anti-Islam. They said proponents of the center say the neighbors have a bias against Muslims and will continue to fight the expansion of the building. But the residents have absolutely every right to fight this. See, this is what they do. They come in, you build it, they come, and when we put the brakes on it or when we complain about it, and rightly so, in which we should, we are called Islamophobes and we are called racist. You know, that one just always floors me there, Jeff and Tim and Vito. And who am I speaking with?
Well, you could try me because I'm all ears. No, you're absolutely right, Kel. It's a common tactic and one that we've seen frequently highlighted in the well, not maybe not in the mainstream media, but in places like Jihad Watch and The Religion of Peace and Pamela Geller's Atlas Shrugs. I'm thinking there was a mosque. Oh goodness me. I'm going to have to find the link. I haven't got the link immediately to hand. But exactly the same pattern as you described. Muslims bought a property. All right, well, if a Muslim buys a property, that's one thing. If he intends to be a good neighbour, then there's absolutely no reason that he shouldn't purchase a property. But when you convert a residential property into a mosque, there are all sorts of issues, as you so rightly say. You're going to have noise problems, you're going to have parking problems, and mm-hmm. you're also going to attract lots more Muslims to the neighborhood. And it's not Islamophobic to complain about all these things, because the quality of your life is directly affected by having a mosque right next door to your house, not to mention the property prices. And we've seen it documented that Muslims acquire properties like this and try to push through a mosque conversion, there seems to be in all too many cases, an undue bias towards jumping through the hoops at city council level or local government level, whatever that might be. And it seems to be that they're able to do it far more easily than you or I would if we wanted to start up a church. I mean, and frequently we see that laws concerning planning applications are frequently flouted. Laws concerning construction are frequently flouted, and even when planning permission has been denied to make the appropriate conversion to the building to turn it into a mosque, they go ahead and do it anyway and dare you to try and do something about it, all of which makes for very bad neighbours. And this is something that we frequently see. I didn't find the links that I needed in advance of the show, so I'm going to have to find them later if I get a few moments. But we see this everywhere. I certainly know of several examples in the United States. I certainly know of several examples in the United Kingdom, and I'm sure Kel could highlight at least a couple of dozen examples in Canada. On the back of that, before I hand the microphone back to you, Kel, I'd just like to say that in the UK, we have got a champion by the name of Gavin Bowby, who runs a group or is involved with a group called the Law and Freedom Foundation. And he has developed the art of opposing mosques in the UK, at least, to, I hesitate to use the words elevating it to an art form, but nevertheless, the arguments that he puts forward are very, very effective and have been used in, at the last time I looked, out of 19 applications for mosques that were made recently, he has succeeded in 17 out of those 19 cases in getting planning permission refused. And out of the two cases that he didn't get, it was because that he was drawn into the planning process at a stage that was a little too late for him to be effective. So he's got a very, very good track record in opposing it. And he doesn't do it on the basis of whether or not the residents are Islamophobic. What he says is that when you take into account the public order issues that will result from having a mosque in a residential area, it could potentially be very, very serious, and that those officials at council level who are involved in approving a mosque under those circumstances could find themselves in the future liable to some very severe penalties indeed. And when that was brought home to the planning officials involved, the overall effect has been to have the planning permission refused where it might otherwise have been granted. So I don't know how easily that process might be applied to the United States and Canada, but it's certainly worth people who are interested in opposing this kind of thing, it's certainly worth them looking into what Gavin Bobie has done in the UK and seeing how well that might apply to Canada. But I just thought I'd mention that as an aside, Kel, and I'll pass the microphone back to you.
Oh, thanks, Tim. And yeah, we actually do. We have issues here in Ontario in particular. It's really bad in the Toronto area, the outskirts, the boroughs of Toronto, in that they not only are they buying up real estate and building these mosques, but they're actually creating entire communities in that it's Muslim only. I mean, this is not enclave. Enclaves to me is when you simply get more and more families, like-minded families moving into an area. That could be in an Italian community, a Greek community, a British community, or whatever. However, a lot of these communities, like the Italians, the Greeks, and the British, they're not enclaves. They're just like-minded communities. Whereas with Islam, they do turn into no-go zones in the end, and that we have to. We're dealing with this an issue right now in Toronto, where they want to establish this community for Muslim families only. What'd you do?
Sorry, Kel, carry on. I'm sorry, I was distracted by a shiny thing. Take no notice. Carry on, Kel. I'll be with you in a second.
Okay. I don't want to know what's going on over there, but okay. But that's okay. Where was I? Oh God! Now
ladies,
people are going to be wondering.
I do apologise for this interruption here. We're normally right on top of it, but I'm busy looking for links, and I detected a hiatus in Kel's delivery, and she was waiting for me to say something, and I was absorbed in looking for a link. So I apologise. Sorry, Kel. Carry on, please.
I'm just trying to. Yeah, what I was doing is that I'm typing away here. I'm trying to find this. This story about this Muslim-only community. And, of course, there is a lot of people are, you know, rightfully upset about this. And they're coming out and saying, well, it's because you hate Muslims and you're just, you're determined to oppress us and keep us down. And that's not the case. The case is that this is Islam being a political entity. And this is something else as well. And this is actually in Thornhill, Ontario, which is a borough of Toronto, and they want to build this this community. And the residents of Thornhill, this community, they're speaking out over a proposal to construct two residential high-rise buildings in a low-density neighborhood. Now, the proposed condos would be built at the Jaffrey Community Center at 9000 Bathurst Street and would contain 377 units. Now, residents who live in the Thornhill Woods neighborhood, located right beside the community center, say they don't want the area to become overcrowded. The Jaffrey Center has submitted a proposal to turn its 30-acre property into a high-density Muslim community, which would include the high-rise building as well as 61 townhouses. Now, residents opposed to the plan have started an online petition, which have garnered over 2,500 signatures by Monday evening. Shabir Jurej, president of the Jaffrey Center, told City News this kind of expansion is going on everywhere in the area, and as far as we are concerned, this is very consistent with all the development that's been going on around us, especially north of Rutherford and Bathurst Streets, he said. Neighborhood residents say they are also concerned because some of the proposed housing will be subsidized, which they believe may decrease their property values, Tim. Meeting has been set up. A meeting was set up for community members to express their concerns. But this is terrible, and this would be Muslim only. You and I, we would not be allowed to move in there. See, this is what I mean, the difference between, say, an Italian community, a Greek community, a UK community. We're not enclaves where we're all inclusive, whereas this would be an enclave where you would not be welcome and would soon become a no-go zone very, very shortly.
Oh, yeah, and we see that a lot over in the UK, of course, where developments like that very quickly do become no-go zones because Muslims do not make good neighbours, and that's whether or not they're building a mosque in your midst. The fact is that once Muslims reach a certain percentage of the population, they make life very uncomfortable for their neighbours, not necessarily through outright violence, but in all sorts of little ways which just make it very clear to non-Muslims that they are not welcome, and nobody wants to live in a place where they don't feel welcome. You know, life is too short, and so what most people do is they don't make a big fuss about it, but they quietly sell up and move, and in no time at all the area becomes 100% Muslim because nobody wants a Muslim for a neighbour, so they just leave, and we see this frequently. And of course any up till recently, any form of protest from people living in areas like that about the low-level intimidation has resulted in no action at all being taken by the authorities who ought to be looking after us and treating us all fairly and equally under the law. They turn a blind eye when it comes to Muslims because they themselves do not want to be classed as racist or Islamophobic, because if a label becomes attached to you when you're in a position of authority like that, say you're in the local council or you're in the police force or the social services where you could make a difference in theory, if you get the label of racist or Islamophobe attached to you, that can be a career killer. So the natural human thing is for people not to make a fuss, and consequently the indigenous population are thereby discriminated against.
Sorry, I had myself on mute because I went to that link that you put in the chat room, and that's Gavin Bowlby on YouTube. So I put myself on mute just in case it started to play on me, and all you could hear was Gavin Bowlby. So sorry about that, folks. Sorry, Tim. But that's exactly the case in that, you know, I'm just reading the chat room. And, Vito is saying the Islamic education movement would be interesting. It would confuse Muslims like the Radio Jihad Network names confuse them.
Yes, indeed. The other thing I was going to say about that Gavin Bobie is that he was also, as an aside, he was part of the report that came out recently, or he was one of the authors of the report that came out recently concerning Muslim paedophile gangs. And I'm really quite impressed with the Law and Freedom Foundation in that respect.
Yeah.
They produced a very interesting report, which we have discussed on the show previously. But I just thought I'd mention it because it's the same Law and Freedom Foundation report, Law and Freedom Foundation group that Gavin is involved with, and the Mosque Buster Project is part of their remit as well.
You know, there are so many stories in here, and, you know, we have more stories, and the hits just keep on coming. But I did want to bring attention to the listeners. I put a slide up there in the chat room, folks. If you go up there, I've put in a few slides in that that do pertain to that Muslims are not the victims. We are. Women under the thumb of Islam are victims. Children under the thumb of Islam are victims. Animals under the thumb of Islam are victims. Now, if you go up and take a look at the slides about the show notes, you're going to see a photo of a little boy. Well, he's not a little boy. He's a young lad. He's 15 years old, and his name is Luke Rolfe. Now, when he was 15 at the time, he saw a group of people in a garden kicking and badly beating this poor fox. They had taped the mouth shut with duct tape. And this young man, he went straight to them without concerns for his own safety. The world really needs more brave hearts like Luke Rolfe, with an unconditional willingness to help those in need. It doesn't matter if the fox was a pest or not. Respect life. You don't duct tape its mouth shut and beat it. Now, I'm going to put the link in the chat room. You can read this for yourselves later. One thing that this particular story omits, though, is that the group of grown men torturing this fox were Muslims. And this took place in the UK. And so this little boy, well, I shouldn't call him a little boy. He's a young man. He was 15 at the time, so Cal, come on. But he saw what was going on, and you can see he's holding this poor fox. He's got blood all over his white T-shirt. The fox's snout is duct-taped, and the look of distress on his face, when they say a picture is worth a thousand words, that is so true. And, of course, you know my affiliation for little foxies. And so I wanted to include that because we are talking about the victimization of us, as opposed to Islamists being victimized, which they are not. They are the perpetrators of victimization. They make our lives a living hell. They hurt us. They hurt our women, they hurt our children, and they hurt our animals. And this is what we've been talking about. They are playing the Islamic victim card again. And if you were late into the show, please re-listen in archive, because we played a wonderful clip by Dr. Bill Warner about Islamic victims that he had put out just a couple of days ago. So please listen to that. But Tim, this is exactly what I mean. They have absolutely no regard for human life. They have no regard for sentient life. And they come after us and call us Islamophobes and racists. What?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is it's typical Muslim behavior, I'm sorry to say. And part of the problem, of course, is that when you have a doctrine that demonizes anything that is not strictly Islamic, then you do tend to bring out the worst in human nature with that doctrine. As our listeners, I'm sure, are aware, Islam divides the world into two. There is the world that is Islamic, and there is the world that is not. And it's the duty of every Muslim to enhance and expand everything that's Islamic to the detriment of everything that is not Islamic. And all right, you might think, well, that's just a geographical thing, but it's not. It's a way of dividing people as well into people who are like you and who you treat with respect, and people and other sentient beings who are not like you, and that you can feel free to treat completely ruthlessly and mercilessly, because the Quran gives you divine permission to be ruthless towards non-believers. And by extension, you can be ruthless and heartless towards anybody and anything who does not share your viewpoint, your way of life. Now, when it comes to having concern for or pity for poor defenseless animals, they certainly do not share the same characteristics that we do in our civilization. We understand that all life is precious, and that we should not take life without an overriding reason. And I'm not about to get into what might be overriding reasons in this show, because that's another philosophical discussion for another day. But what it does mean is that there's an enormous difference between how we view the sanctity of life and how Muslims view it. And Muslims don't have any regard for the sanctity of life or for the suffering of others at all. Their doctrine, their theology, actually brings out, as I say, brings out the worst aspects of humanity. It's completely the opposite to Christianity, which, when applied in its true form, brings out the best in people, in my view. All right, again, that's a discussion maybe for another day, but the point is that there is a complete 180-degree shift when it comes to viewing the sanctity of life as far as Muslims and Islam is concerned. And that's why you see acts of unspeakable cruelty everywhere in the Muslim world on a daily basis. And whether it's hacking the head. Hello, I'm still here. Can you hear me? Hello,
yeah,
can you still hear me?
Yeah, you just dropped out for a sec. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. Just to go back a sentence, the doctrine of Islam happens is that if you inculcate the doctrine of Islam into your life, you develop a sociopathic outlook towards anything and everything that is not Muslim, and you have no regard for the sanctity of human or animal life at all. And that's why you see such unspeakable cruelty everywhere in the Muslim world on a daily basis. And you've only got to look at YouTube. I mean, this is one example. Red Fox is, you know, they're close to my heart as well. Other animals, you frequently see pictures on YouTube of poor defenseless animals being tortured by Muslims, and it's a frequent thing, and they think absolutely nothing of it. There's no equivalent of the Royal Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals anywhere in the Muslim world, and that's because the way of thinking, well, I know I'm repeating myself here, but it does bring out the worst in people, and the world is better off without it, in my view.
I'm
Kel,
just,
you there?
I'm just overwhelmed by all of this, and that I'm just responding. No way has a link that he's going to look for and send to us, but I can't believe this. We're down to virtually our last 15 minutes of talking points, but there was something I wanted to talk with you about, Tim, and this is that you are now writing for the Brenner Brief, and that is based out of the United States. And you had been writing about the Birmingham Trojan Horse in particular, and I came across this article. I came across two of them, which I sent to you. But now we're getting noises from, once again, the Islamists, that they feel they are the victim of a witch hunt. So if you want to briefly explain what the Trojan Horse in Birmingham is, and maybe have a rebut for those Islamists who think that we're on nothing more than a witch hunt, by all means, please have at her.
Yes, indeed. Well, for those of you who haven't heard about this particular story, this is coming out of Birmingham in the United Kingdom, my hometown, and it concerns schools in the local area. And the story started when an anonymous letter was apparently leaked to the authorities about the possible takeover of one or more schools in the Birmingham area by Islamist hardliners. And the letter, which to be fair, it may or may not have been a hoax, we don't know at this stage, outlined a procedure whereby schools might be taken over by getting rid of non-Muslim head teachers and governors, and replacing them in ways, various stealthy ways, you might say, by Islamic teachers, head teachers and governors. And the letter was taken sufficiently seriously by the education secretary over here, Michael Gove, who organized a quite a draconian response. Well, I say draconian for a minister when it comes to acting as quickly, as swiftly as Michael Gove did, based on a letter which might or might not have been a hoax. That's a pretty quick response, so he is to be commended for that. But the investigation is being called the Trojan Horse investigation, and for reasons that hopefully will become clear as I elaborate on the story. And it appears that it's certainly been true that some teachers and head teachers and governors have been intimidated and bullied out of their positions by Muslims in order to get Islamist hardliners in their place. And the word witch hunt was employed by one particular governor called Tahir Alam. Now, regular listeners who are up to date on the various and nefarious, I might say, activities of Tahir Alam will be aware that he's quite active as a political Muslim with Islamist associations. And the fact that he's been allowed to hold a position on the governing board of one particular school is certainly a matter of concern. And what happened this week, and I have been writing to an online magazine called The Brenner Brief about this, and if you go to brennerbrief.com, you will see one of the stories that they've very kindly published on this particular subject. But what happened was that Michael Gove decided he was going to get in a counter-terrorism professional to head up the investigation, at which point it's fair to say that all hell broke loose, because the head of the city council, the chief constable of West Midlands Police, and various other notables all realised that something serious was going to happen if this was going to allow to proceed, because they'd been operating many years very stealthily and very comfortably, putting up with Muslims taking over various positions in authority in local government, schools and so on in the area. And all this was, the process was likely to be exposed. So Tahir Alam went on to national radio and TV to denounce all this as a witch hunt with no, basis at all. Sorry, was that you, Kel? Kel, are you still there? I'll carry on talking on the basis that I'm hoping.
Yeah, I've got something going on here. I've got some sort of pop-up, and I don't know where on earth it's coming from, and I'm just trying to find it. I've got a few pages open, so my apologies to you, Tim, and to everybody else about that.
I got
a pop-up that decided to start playing.
Okay, should I carry on with that, Kel, or do you need to do anything there?
Yes, please do.
Yeah, okay. All right, so we've got a counter-terrorism professional that's coming in to look at the investigation, which has been labelled the Trojan Horse investigation, and a lot of local people are very upset about it. The chief constable said it was desperately unfortunate and sent out all the wrong messages. The head of the city council, Sir Albert Bohr, said that it was regrettable, and he hoped that the counter-terrorism professional would work closely with the people already in the council. Well, yes, I bet he does, because if he doesn't, he'll probably expose all sorts of practices that the city council don't want exposed. The latest person to enter the fray, another person to enter the fray was the Right Reverend Bishop of Birmingham, who said that it would demonise Muslims and that it would encourage extremist right-wingers to vent their Islamophobia. So predictable, Mr. Bishop. Well, I shouldn't really call him Mr. Bishop, Right Reverend. And the latest person to jump into the fray was an ex-councillor called Salma Yaqub. Again, another Muslim political activist who I think is now a spokesperson for Birmingham Central Mosque, if I'm not very much mistaken. And she was making all sorts of allegations as late as Friday last week about how inappropriate it was to jump to conclusions about Muslims on the basis of this letter, and how Muslims, again, were always going to be the victims of such investigations and never the perpetrators. So it just goes to show, really, that what we've been talking about in terms of Muslims claiming victimhood at every opportunity is just a part of a tried and tested pattern. Muslims obviously feel it's worked well enough for them in the past, and instead of saying to themselves, well, maybe we do have a bit of a problem with Islam in that its political goals are not compatible with this wonderful Western civilization that we have been so lucky to be able to come and live in, instead of saying that, they are just playing the victim card over and over again, and this is just one more example. So while it's not surprising, it's a little bit disappointing. So have you managed to get rid of that pop-up, Kel? Because that sounded like it was going to get in the way of what we wanted to do between now and the end of the show.
Yeah, I got rid of it. It was just I had another page open. I was bringing up another article. And actually, Noe sent us a great clip, and it wasn't that one. It was just I went to Brenner Brief so I could put your article in the chat room, and Sarah started speaking.
Oh, yes, of course. Okay. I forgot to mention that, Kel, that I noticed that before, and when you open up that page, it does activate a couple of pop-ups. Okay, not to worry, but thank you for putting the link in the chat room anyway. But that's the article, or that is the story in a nutshell. I've been covering it this week for the Brenner Brief, and the Brenner Brief have just started publishing one or two of the articles that I have sent to them, and that is just one of them. It's not the complete story in that article, but what I've been talking about just now is covered in that story.
And there'll be more to follow on this. I find this to be a rather fascinating story in that why do they always feel they have to play the victim card when they know that they're perpetrating? And the majority of atrocities taking place globally, Tim, is perpetrated by Islam, and they come to the West and they want to build a mosque in the middle of a suburban neighborhood, or they want to have their Islam-only neighborhoods. And why is it that we're allowing this to go on, and why is it that we feed into their self... I said self-imposed, but I shouldn't use that term. What I really should say is that their self... disillusion of victimhood. Yeah, they're disillusioned. They're not victims at all. And, they get away with it. Agador is right. It's worked for them for 1,400 years.
Well, that is the primary reason. It has worked for them for 1,400 years. And in the manner of a lot of success stories, I suppose the way they're looking at it is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If they carry on doing what they're doing, committing these various atrocities when they think it's expedient, claiming playing the victim straight afterwards and doing everything they can to distract attention from the true doctrine of warfare that Islam has at its heart towards non-believers, which is eternal and valid for all times and all places. If they can do all these things and keep our guard down and avoid any possibility of us non-Muslims finding out the truth about Islam, then they will succeed in the way that they've succeeded many times before in destroying and destroying civilizations which have subsequently disappeared without trace. But I see no good reason why that should happen to our civilization, because we have tremendous advantages with the internet, with social media, Twitter, Facebook, Blog Talk Radio, you and me, Kel. And we have a means of getting the message out to people of goodwill who open their ears and their hearts to us. And if enough people of goodwill realize the truth about Islam, then I think it's fair to say that we would not stand for Islam in this country one more moment. It is completely incompatible with our civilization. It's completely incompatible with all the freedoms that our forefathers handed down to us for safekeeping, for us to pass on to our children and grandchildren, and has to be constrained. It has to be checked. It has to be stopped. The encroachment has to be stopped, and we have to turn the tide. Many people on the left of the political spectrum would try and sell us the concept that discrimination and intolerance is wrong under any circumstances. But I disagree, and this is an argument I have put forward before, is that discrimination can be a very important part of survival. And I made a rather facile observation on a previous show. You imagine a Stone Age hunter who's out hunting for food, and he can't tell the difference between a harmless little pussycat and a big man-eating saber-toothed tiger that's hiding around the corner. He ain't going to last very long. And so a certain amount of discrimination is built into our very nature in order to help us survive. And if we suppress our ability to discriminate when our very survival depends on it, we are going to come unstuck very quickly. And this is what's happening now. We're being told that discrimination is wrong under any circumstances, when it is not. It is not wrong to discriminate against something that is evil. And if we lose the ability to discriminate between good and evil, we're not headed for a good place, I can tell you that. And the same goes for tolerance as well. If we tolerate the very intolerance that is the source of all the problems that we see within Islam, we are not doing ourselves any favor either. So discrimination and intolerance can be good things. The ability to discriminate and the can be a good thing, and the will to be intolerant when it's necessary is a good thing, and we need to be applying these things to Islam. But the reason it's successful is because we're allowing it to be successful. Islam is not doing anything different than it was over the last 1400 years, as Agador pointed out, and it's down to us to inject some common sense into the situation and do something about it in our case, our job is to make everybody aware of what the reality is rather than what the fantasy that our political elites would like to have us believe. They would like us to believe that Islam is benign and tolerant and so on, when it's none of these things. And we have to proceed based on reality rather than on fantasy.
And that's exactly it. And I don't believe this, Tim, but guess what? We're out of time again. Do you believe that?
Oh, wow. Yeah, how about that? Doesn't time fly when you're enjoying yourself?
Absolutely.
Yes, we certainly covered a lot of ground. I'll have to say that. And I do hope that I've not I've not upset our listeners with going off topic a little bit now and again during the course of the show, I'm very glad that we have a very tolerant.
Oh goodness! No. Go off topic anytime you want. I mean, that's half the fun of doing a live show. We never know where it's going to take us.
Yeah,
so I think it's fantastic. But one thing I think that we can conclude is that the Islamic card playing the victim card is nothing more than a...
Yes, indeed.
Whiners.
Yes, indeed.
But we are out of time. We want to thank you all for being here. Oh, Luchadora came in and joined us too. She's part of the Radio Jihad Network family over there as well. And I and myself, and I think there's this guy named Tim, although I think I've been calling him everybody else's name tonight. But we want to thank A12 Iggy Mom, congratulate her for winning that coveted, mendacious, grievance-mongering Takiya artist coffee mug.
Yes, congratulations. Yes, indeed.
Yeah,
yes.
And just to remind people that Tim and myself, we are the co-host at the Radio Jihad Network. We're the freedom-loving infidels. Our boss is Vito Esposito, who is also in our chat room. And Vito has a show in... 65 minutes. So please get over there to the Radio Jihad Network and listen to Vito tonight, 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 11 p.m. British Summertime. And Tim, I want to thank you very much for taking my wonky watch and taking it in and getting it prepared for me.
Absolutely. No trouble at all, Kel. I mean, I know it's difficult to count on one's fingers when you know you've got six fingers on each hand. But there you go.
Yeah.
That's what comes of being born in Norfolk, you know.
And the abacus around the wrist was getting a little weighty.
Yes, indeed. So I'm glad we got all that cleared up.
And, yep, ladies and gentlemen, we will see you at the Radio Jihad Network tomorrow night, 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And our guest is going to be Audrey Russo. And please join us for that. And that's going to be exciting. Audrey is one of my heroes. I admire her greatly. And she is a very, very, very gracious lady. And she is going to share her insights about her work combating Islam herself. So, ladies and gentlemen, on that note, thank you all very much. Please have a wonderful evening. We will see you at Vito Esposito's place a little later on at the Radio Jihad Network. And not to forget that Luchadora has her show with the Eliza Jane on Wednesdays at the Radio Jihad Network. So there you go, Tim.
Yes, indeed. And once again, I'd like to say thank you very much to our listeners and apologize for the few lapses in concentration that we had during the show. And I hope you'll all forgive us because it was all done for the best possible reasons. We like looking up links for you guys, but sometimes when you're trying to talk and find links at the same time, well, you guys know what it's like when it comes to multitasking. Kel, of course... Kel, of course,
I'm usually better at it.
Yeah, with no problems with multitasking normally, so I think we'll gloss over that. And just to say, please do join us again next week for another great show. And thank you for being with us again today.
You betcha. And Tim, have yourself a wonderful evening, and I will talk with you tomorrow at the Radio Jihad Network. Ladies
yes,
and gentlemen... Thank you all for being here. And remember, it is mass Islamity, and we have to stop the insanity. Good night, everybody, and good night, Tim.
Yes, good night, everyone, and good night, Kel. You take care now.
Will do. Slow startup.
I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb. Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had. Yeah. carry on another day. Another day goes by and you're outside, still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive, until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy, once your foolish pride, once your beautiful joy. Even what's left of a candy bar when it's like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Playing with a piece of driftwood, they create a little mind made into a beautiful toy. And at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats, your deep respect over a thousand men, gave you the will to get back up on your feet again. Because you knew right then this battle wasn't about you, it's all about them. And you reassured them like only a daddy can. And they knew right then that everything was gonna be alright. Of harm's way, putting in all those hours, and all my friends working day and night, making it right here, tunnel of towers, bringing us hope like a ray of sunshine, peeking through the clouds, clearing the showers. Well, here's to you, two shots of whiskey, one Jameson, one Johnny Powers. From Coney Island to Seaside Heights, Long Beach, Freeport, the Lower East Side, Mass or Pequot to Sheepshead Bay, a city out into the Rockaway, Howard Beach to Tottenville. Bye.